to Stargate Fun, a podcast where we talk about episodes of the original Stargate One series. I'm Trishy Matson.
I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm David Schaub.
And today we're starting with Season 3, Episode 9, Rules of Engagement, and I believe Andrew has the recap for us.
I do. SG-1 encounters an unknown SG team fighting Jafam, but they turn out to be new human recruits for the Goa'uld system ward Apophis, training to infiltrate Earth. SG-1 turns one recruit away from Apophis by showing him a film of Apophis dying from last season's episode 17, Serpent Song, which sort of makes this a quip show. SG-1 returns to the planet and braves the crossfire of the recruit's final challenge to show the same video via Apophis's Vocume projector technology, which stops the battle and makes everyone go home.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I don't think it really counts as a clip show because it's just one clip.
Right. And
also, a short clip at that.
And also, it wasn't like the death, though, because the symbiote died and then the body died, but we got all those scenes of the host. So it's like, what are they seeing? My initial takeaway was no one today on a battlefield is going to believe a projected video of their leader's death. Like, no one's going to believe that. Like, how in the world would anyone believe this? I have some issues with this episode.
Well, these guys apparently have not been exposed to disinformation videos on social media.
Right.
Having none of that.
To say the least.
And so they see it and they believe it.
But that's the thing. Like, half of this episode is about how they're trained and going to be infiltrators and going to be spies. And then the other half of the episode is they're idiots and they have no context for anything that's going on around them and nothing they do makes sense. And I just, I couldn't disassociate between those two kind of parallel plots in this episode.
Yes, I don't think they're actually going to get very far in their infiltration on the information that the major crops of North America are, what was it, corn and cotton? Yeah, so right. As we progress through the episode, we find out that a missing Stargate 11 team went missing some time ago, and it turns out that Apophis captured them and tortured them to get information out of them about Earth defenses, and after a while, some cultural information. So we are sorry, you know, raise a glass to SG-11, all dead now.
Yep.
But yeah, I really don't think that they would get enough good information out of that situation to pass for long.
Right. It seems like the focus of the episode, right, like, and I've talked about this before, right, I tend to sort of think in terms of, like, what did the writers really want to do in the episode? And then they had to sort of work backwards and make the rest of the story out from that. And obviously the thing that they really wanted to do in this episode was have this fake U.S. Army or military camp that was in fact Jaffa and or, you know, human recruits of Apophis. That was the cool idea that they had. And then they had to go and make an entire story around it. And so I do think that you're absolutely right. Like, they didn't really try to make it feel all that believable as a threat to the SGC that these recruits were going to be able to come into it. But that wasn't really their plan, I don't think. Like, the episode winds up being about how SG-1 and the SGC kind of feel like they need to save these recruits from being senselessly killed in the final challenge. And that's kind of it. You know, so it does take away a lot of the suspense that, like, it's not actually really a danger. Like, when they go back to the planet to save these kids, they're not doing it for any other reason than just to save these kids. They could let them all die. They are recruits of Apophis, and they are brainwashed to believe him. But they've decided that they're going to be, you know, sort of nice people and help them out in ways that they otherwise wouldn't need to. I do love, they always have this scene when SG-1 is going to do something ridiculously dangerous that no actual military commander would let them do, that, you know, Hammond always has to sort of say, well, you know, how about, what if we didn't do it? And he's got a half-heartedly kind of, you know, say, what if we didn't risk you all on this thing that doesn't have anything to do with us? And then, you know, they convince him very easily, of course. So, yeah, I also think that, you know, there's a lot of things which don't make a lot of which strain credibility here. Right. Where did they get all the equipment? You know, they have an entire camp's worth of tents and Intar weapons that somebody had to make, you know, based on MP5s and everything that, you know, okay, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I also love the Vocuum technology, which is basically like, you know, basically the equivalent of an answering machine message, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Please leave a message at the tone and I will get back to you. Apophis made no safeguards that, like, the person who was going to use this Vocuum would not use it to exercise his authority against his wishes, right? And
yeah, that's a lot of confidence in whoever gets left with the device. Not only that they'll be honest, but that it won't fall into anybody else's hands.
Right.
As it did.
So yeah, like, and I think some of it comes down to, you know, they were trying to keep the episode simple. They were trying to keep the technology simple and understandable for everyone. Well, certainly in these day and age, when we have sort of like, you know, AI and adaptive kind of technology and everything else, the idea that you would just have this one simple message for technology that is supposed to be thousands and thousands of years ahead of ours is, yes, it also strains credulity quite a bit with that, that this would be how they would work. But of course, it's needed to make the story work.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought that was a little funny.
Really, I felt that this entire episode could have been the B plot for some other story.
Yeah.
It just feels unnecessary and only mildly interesting.
I think there's lots of credulity issues here with just me getting my head around what they're trying to sell me, and I'm just not really buying it. I might have wished I hadn't watched this episode, which is always a bit unfortunate. The other two episodes I had to watch, I also have issues with. But this one, I don't feel I had to watch, and I had issues with it, which made it challenging. I mean, I agree that this is about, let's save these kids. And I'm like going, they're enemy combatants on either side of a war. I mean, if they were Jaffa, would you be so trying to save them? Like, I don't understand. There's just so many aspects of this plot machination house of cards they had to build up so they could take it down just the right way. And yep. I suspect it's not going to have, like, I'm still going into this episode assuming we're going to see Apophis again, because as far as the show's told us, Sakura may have been able to revive him still. So it's like, I don't know, what I care? Do I care? It's challenging about these, yes, they're brainwashed, but I mean, the Jaffa are effectively brainwashed and just have a snake in their belly. I don't know. So much of this just felt so strange. And we're supposed to care about these kids because they're acting like humans? Is that the reason? Like, it just...
Well, I think they are humans. And one thing that struck me is that all these soldiers...
Sorry, acting like Earthlings, I should say. Sorry, acting like Earthlings.
Ah.
Yes, of course, they're humans.
They're humans, and one thing that struck me is that they are all so young. Compared to the SG team, these are all fresh-faced kids. Apparently, they've been here 5 cycles, however long that is, seasons or years or something, training. But they all just look like almost babies in uniform.
The setup almost feels like they're trying to do Lord of the Flies.
Hmm.
Like, that's the only thing this kind of feels like. But it's just this idea of a small group outside of a war that don't know the war is over. Like, that's more generally what this is trying to cover.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't believe that we're ever going to see Intars again, which I think are really sad because they're now the most useful weapon that we've seen
right. In
Stargate, is that they stun people but don't kill them. So they're generally really easy to have around and just shoot everyone.
Right.
Shoot first, ask questions later becomes a perfectly valid approach, which this show could probably use. But I don't expect we'll ever see them again. It's like a puzzle box where I didn't really want to see it opened.
Yeah.
Honestly, the biggest issue I think I had with this episode was Teal'c, in that the show needs O'Neill to be the leader and the person doing the stuff and being the action and being the instigator and the primary protagonist. And O'Neill has no reason to be talking at all in this episode. And all it's doing is delaying these windows where Teal'c tells us what's actually going on, and then Teal'c stops talking, and then we just go off into La La Land for a little bit with O'Neill going off about things, and then Teal'c comes back and tells us something useful. And it's like, why isn't Teal'c doing all of the talking in this episode? Why does it take Teal'c so long to recognize what's going on?
Yeah.
He doesn't seem to recognize Intars until he does. And he doesn't seem to recognize what's going on until he does and needs to give that drop of information so that O'Neill can then go off and do a spiel, which doesn't really make sense. Like, the fact that Jaffa couldn't come here and actually order them to stop, like, why would you build troops that don't listen to their commanders?
Mm-hmm.
Ever? Like, that was beyond me. And even before that, like, even the fact that it bothers me that Teal'c wasn't just sort of put in charge, and why would they keep letting O'Neill talk, it was just melted my brain. I don't understand why these people reacted to SG-1. They're supposed to infiltrate SGC and attack SGC. They're supposed to obviously recognize Stargate teams. SG-1 is presumably the most well-known Stargate team. They know it's SG-1, but they then act like they're in authority of them because they happen to have a Jaffa with them who they know is a traitor. Like, why do they respect the SG-1 team at all? They're the enemy. They know they're the enemy, don't they? So it's this even the thing where Teal'c is given power doesn't do anything useful with it, but I don't even know why he was being given the influence to begin with.
Yeah, I do think, so one of the things you said, sort of Lord of the Flies, but boring, I think is kind of one way to look at it. It's funny because I think you had sort of a more visceral reaction to this episode than I did. I do think it's a matter of degree. Like, I think all SG-1 episodes have lots of things about them that you have to suspend disbelief about.
Yep.
And this one kind of went over the line for you.
Yes, exactly.
Whereas the ones that are more enjoyable to us are actually not that much worse than this. It's just that this one went over the line with you. I do think that there are ways to hand wave, you know, that, like, to say that the new recruits weren't even told about Teal'c because they're just new recruits. They were given a really, really small amount of information about what they are. That could explain that. I think the idea that, again, they're made to believe that there are other things that they don't know, and therefore that's why the SG-1 was considered another team that's also training instead of another one. But sure, if it's strange credulity, then it's strange credulity. I think in as much as this episode is enjoyable to me, I think a lot of the credit goes to that actor who plays Kyle, Captain Kyle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Aaron Craven. He's good, right? He kind of sells the idea that this is someone who's sort of in charge and confident, but then also shaken when he sees that Apophis is quote-unquote dead. So I think, you know, in as much as this works at all, I think it's because he provides that human element there and allows us to sort of see what these kids are feeling in a way that makes us sympathize with them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, you know, you kind of talked about how, yes, Sokar has Apophis. I do, for me, that was one of the big interesting things about how they had to simplify this story down is that everyone in SG-1 kept saying, Apophis is dead, Apophis is dead, when they know he isn't dead. He's actually a prisoner of Sokar. But that's too complicated, right? You can't tell these recruits, oh, Apophis isn't your god because he's a prisoner of another god and being tortured there. That's that, you know, again, that's too weird, right? You have to say, well, he's dead, when more technically he died, right? And gods shouldn't die. And we know he died. But yeah, that was the thing that I kept kind of yelling in my head about that, but he's not dead. But it's also, you know, I could live with the story in the moment and be there. So
the line was right there. The guy, the one said, go to Sokar. They could have said, no, Apophis went to Sokar. And it's just, they just entirely missed the opportunity.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's little bits which I did like. I really quite liked the bit where they accidentally say Chapai. And it's like, oh, crap, we screwed up. You should shoot us now. Like, oh, so bad. Oh. Like, I really kind of found, I mean, bits like that, they were kind of fun. It just, it went downhill very quickly from that part when they tried to actually make a plot out of it.
Well, and I think, yeah.
I agree, though, that the guest stars did perfectly adequate jobs. Like, I have no issues with them in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, like, so this was a slow burn, and I think all of the episodes that we're going to be looking at today are like slow burns, right? There's not a huge, it's not like nothing frenetic is happening in these episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they,
it's funny, they all, well, the first two end with big action sequences, but then suddenly we're in slow burn land. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I do think that this episode especially, although I think they all do it to a degree, kind of use that slow burn to have some, like, humorous moments in it, right? Like, there was a lot of humor to be mined from the fact that they don't, you know, these are kids who are giving them orders, or they don't know exactly what's going on, and yet it's, like, kind of SG world. And so they did try to make it humorous in it. And I, you know, of course, whether the jokes landed or not, you know, their humor is not particularly subtle or innovative. But I do think that it's interesting that there was more humor in a lot of these episodes than there might have been if they were trying to ratchet up the tension and give us something more fraught all the way through. That makes sense?
Yep. I think there's one bit of subtlety I missed in my first watching, which when Jackson...
You watched it twice?
Well, yeah. I regretted watching it the first time. It wasn't better the second. But there was a nice subtlety I missed when I first watched, which was when Jackson was basically saying that we needed to take the captain back to SGC or he'll die. I think he's just lying. Like, it might have been possible that it was necessary, but probably not. And we definitely found out at SGC he was probably fine.
Yep.
It didn't get the impression that he actually needed the help. It's just they wanted to take him away. And I actually liked that bit and the bluff to get him to SGC. And then he was very unimpressed with that. I kind of liked all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'll give one bit of credit to the line, "I have glorious news." That seemed very appropriate to the tone of the episode.
All right, y'all ready to move on to the next episode?
Sure.
Absolutely.
All right, Season 3, Episode 10, Forever in a Day. David, take it away.
SG-1 rescues Abadonians, including Share's father, on P8X873, near a tent where Amonet is hanging out. Lots of Jaffa show up and attack. Jackson follows Amonet alone because he's an idiot, and she tries to kill him very slowly. Kilk shows up and shoots Amonet. Many interwoven dreams show Jackson that Share wants him to forgive Teal'c and find her son because he is Harsesis, a human with the knowledge of all Go'uld. Why this is important is unclear. Share dies, and the most poorly utilized character in SG-1 is fridged.
Yes, it's such a pity. Share was such a good character.
In the movie.
In the movie, yes. So underutilized in the series. She has been Daniel's motivation for so long, and just to have it be, you know, at first, you know, I thought that it was just an off-screen death and we weren't even going to get to see her death. Later we do, but it's still, this is a sad ending for what could have been and was in the movie such a good character. We mourn you, Share. But we have to deal with the episode that we were given. Amonet, of course, is the Go'uld who has taken over Share as a host. And Amonet and, was it Apophis? Had a kid before using their human bodies. And this child.
Which is icky, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's a total violation of the human bodies, the hosts. But anyway, this son, who apparently Daniel was content to consign to perdition and never do anything about until he got some dreams, even though it was the son of the woman he loved, he was willing to, you know, just let that drop entirely. I am not pleased with how Daniel behaves in this episode.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, it's kind of dream Daniel.
No. Daniel in real life is a real jerk. He basically says the only person on the team that he cares about at all is Carter, not O'Neill, not even Teal'c. Just Carter. She's the only one he's going to miss just a little bit. And he is just cold and uncaring. And maybe this is what he does when he grieves. Maybe he just retreats into himself and becomes a jerk. Everybody has different ways of mourning. But it sure doesn't like make me like him. And it kind of foreshadows later evolutions of Daniel where he becomes rather withdrawn. So I don't think it's just how he mourns. He seems to be actually, he cares about people en masse, but he sure doesn't seem to have much personal emotion, affection. So that is not a fun revelation about Daniel for me.
Yeah, I think that when they were, I think we've talked about how Michael Shanks was kind of given the role of Daniel Jackson because he could do a pitch-perfect James Spader impression, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we're what we're seeing now is the beginning of Michael Shanks playing Daniel Jackson in kind of his own style that is different than James Spader, that it's really kind of his own way of doing it, his own mannerisms, his own speaking style. And I do think that this kind of new version of Daniel Jackson is kind of a big fat jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And that is unfortunate that that's kind of the direction that they feel like going with him. And sure, you could kind of say that this is him being in mourning. But the fact that he, you know, again, he's supposed to have this deep relationship with, you know, Jack O'Neill, right? Like they bonded right during the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of saw that at the beginning of, mm-hmm. you know, episode one of season one. That and then that seems to be gone now. And of course, a lot of that's the writing that they decided not to emphasize that at all for dramatic reasons. But it is.
Yeah, but we have had some episodes with some real emotional moments between O'Neill and Jackson. Like, for instance, I know that y'all are not fond of the sarcophagus drug addiction episode, but you know, O'Neill helps Jackson through the withdrawal and everything in that. And, you know, there have been many episodes where O'Neill has risked his life to save Jackson, and vice versa, if I recall correctly. And it just seems odd for him to be, I'm not going to miss you because I haven't appreciated your salty jokes. Either he's feeling like he's been abused by O'Neill, which hasn't been the tone that we've had. I've always viewed it as affectionate ribbing, but maybe it really, really gets under Dr. Jackson's skin. Or maybe he's just having a real personality change after Charest's death, which I guess is plausible.
I think I had a somewhat different interpretation of the episode. And really, when I was originally doing the recap, I tried to map out the different threads, and then it was just too long because there's just too many. But my final interpretation of the show is the only things that actually happened in the continuity of the show is the first scene and the last scene, and everything else was a dream because it was just interspersed with different versions of dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now that might not be the case.
No, that I think that's true. I would agree with that.
That was my final interpretation of it, which is all of it is a dream until we see him, and that all basically happened starting when Charest started blasting him with a hand device and ended when we saw Teal'c shoot Charest, and that all of it was just entirely a dream sequence in there. I don't think that takes away from what you're saying, though, because I don't think this isn't still Jackson.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my interpretation of the flow of events is there's kind of, I call it a dream one, which is the one that's the most realistic, and then interspersed with different versions of the dream until the end. But I could see both interpretations.
All right. So, yeah, in your view, just the first scene and the last scene are real, and everything about Daniel quitting the team and Dr. Rothman joining the team and not having fun.
I interpret that all as a dream sequence.
All a dream. Okay. Well, it makes sense then that someone kind of familiar to Jackson would be his dream replacement, that he'd just slide that in. Okay, that's an interesting way to do it, but and that just means that in his own head,
he's a jerk. Yes, exactly. It doesn't actually contradict anything you said.
Okay.
Well,
interesting.
I'm not sure if you've heard of a story called "An Occurrence at Owl Creek" by Ambrose Bierce.
Mm-hmm.
It was published in 1890. Pretty famous. I read it in school at one point, but it is a story about a man who was about to be hanged in the Civil War, American Civil War, and he has an entire whole sequence that he experiences in his head in those split seconds between when the hanging starts and when the hanging ends. It's a really famous example of sort of unreliable narrator and having sort of dreamlike sequences that seem like they're taking a long time in a very short amount of time. I'm almost positive that the people who wrote this episode have read that story and were using that as a basis for this. Daniel Jackson is having a near-death moment. He's dying, and he's having all of these dreams and all of these experiences that seem to be taking days and weeks and months right in that time.
All right.
So again, I think that's where they're coming from for this. It's still his mind and it's still his real reactions to all of these things happening, I think. And that's where I think Mantrish sort of come to this idea that, well, this is Daniel Jackson in the middle of it. But again, it's a dream. It's also a dream. So it's also David's interpretation. But
Yeah, I'm coming around to this. After all, the episode title is Forever in a Day.
Exactly. Like I saw
Forever in a Day, not And a Day.
I saw the title and I said, I don't know if I believe that anything that's going to happen in this episode is real. I came in with that assumption because of the title.
Yeah. When I did think that, you know, okay, so Dan was being a jerk through a lot of it, but the end of it, and I, you know, when I originally saw this in, you know, 1999, whenever it was, I was also, you know, I had been discouraged by the fact that they weren't using Sheree very much, discouraged by the fact that they were killing her off in the third season. It felt too soon, right? Because it felt like it was ending her story before they needed to, and with only a few episodes featuring her in between. So, yeah, this was unfortunate. But I do think that sort of watching it now with a little more distance, that ending scene is a good send-off to Sheree. Like, if they're going to kill her off, if they're going to end her story now, this feels like they did her as much justice as the show is ever going to do her, right? And giving her the point where she gets to say goodbye and Daniel gets to say goodbye and they get to say they love each other. So I did really like the end of it. I really liked that. And I did like the arc of, you know, again, he figures out how to forgive Teal'c. I liked that. Even if they kind of had to show him to be a jerk in the middle to give it an arc instead of him just doing it. The thing that, however, that has bugged me a bit, and we did kind of touch on that already, is that they have to bring in this other element, this other story thread of the boy, of the Harcesus. And it's this thing where, like, okay, in addition to having this emotional arc, an emotional journey of accepting her death, accepting Teal'c's responsibility in her death, they also have to set up, I guess, future, you know, right? Some sort of future plot, some sort of future thing about saving the child. Now, they never give him a name, right? And Sheree refers to him as the boy, not my child. And so I do think the show feels a little confused or distant about why we should care about this. And they give us sort of several half reasons, but never a full reason and never commit to it. Like, do they care because this child's going to get killed because the Gould are going to hunt him down? Do they care because it's her child, even though it's kind of her child by what is basically rape? And so she wants to save the life of this child regardless. Do we care because he is the key to fighting the Gould? They don't ever really say that. They kind of mostly talk about the Harcesus as the reason why the kid's going to get killed, as opposed to this can help us defeat the Gould, the Earth defeat the Gould when it's beleaguered by them. So they never quite commit to any of those. It's not, you know, so it's not necessarily love.
Yeah, they do state a couple of times that as the son of two Gould, he will bear the genetic knowledge that the Gould passed down parent to child. And so presumably, you know, that's going to give the SGC, if they can find them, a big leap up in their technology. But a lot of that technology they could get from the Tok'ra.
Yep.
And they've also got other sources of technology, the ancients, and, you know, even other, a few other civilizations that they've stumbled across have advanced tech, whether they will or won't share. So it's not really convincing. I mean, I'm convinced, yes, that the Gould would want to hunt this child down, but I'm not really sure that SGC needs him. Yeah, okay.
That really was the biggest stumbling block for me there, which was he has the information, all the genetic knowledge of the Gould, and I'm going, why do I care? You're friends with the Tok'ra. Every one of those have every bit of information of the Gould.
Mm-hmm.
Heck, you could borrow the gold inside of Teal'c, put it inside of someone and question them for a while. They have all, would have all the information because it's all in Teal'c too. It's like, there are Gould snakes all over this show and all of them have all of this information. So I absolutely buy that the Gould would want to destroy what is effectively, like in Dune or other science fiction, it's an abomination. That is, it's like perfect setup of an abomination, which therefore is culturally unacceptable and must be destroyed. Absolutely, that makes sense from the Gould's perspective. But other than it being Charest's kid and maybe Jackson would care, or maybe Charest would ask Jackson to care, that is believable.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole Hiresis bit is just entirely beyond me. Why... It's the show is setting that up as being Harsesis, is setting that up to be something we should care about. Just very, very much confused me. I was shocked by this episode. I was shocked they killed off Charest like this. Like, I mean, this is the best Charest episode of the TV show. That's not saying very much.
No.
And I was flabbergasted that they would kill her off like this. I was beside myself. And we'll get into the next episode is why it offends me even more. But in having her die off like this and just be such a wasted character just blows me away.
Yeah.
Having her definitively fridged in that not only is she dying, but they're getting rid of her apparently for the purpose of just giving this dude a somewhat different motivation. And that's sort of what happens going forward. That's the only thing that's changed, is now Jackson has a different reason for being an SGC.
Well, also, it opens him up to other...
Well, yes, exactly.
...romantic relationships, which is useful for the writers, even if I don't love it.
And that's why they did this.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely why this happened. That they didn't like it having one of the main cast members they had being... monogamous married person, and they must have been horrified with this as a character in this type of show, and they just had to get rid of Charest, and therefore they got rid of her. It could have been worse, I suppose, but it is cheap and fridgy and just so unfortunate, and I was so horrified. I absolutely had to see this episode, but wow, did it offend me, not really even from the a Watsonian perspective, but it's just this is the hand of the show saying, we'd like him not to be married anymore. And it's like, wow, that's cheap. There was this whole...
Yeah, I don't know if it's a failure of the writer's room that they just don't want to go deep on any character, and especially not on a female character. Charest could have been so much more for this entire series, but not. But, I mean, they have a problem. They don't go real deep on most of the characters usually, except for special episodes, but they particularly don't go deep on many women with emotions.
This show has always hated Charest.
Mm. Andrew, what were you going to say?
Well, so I have a different interpretation of what happens in the next episode.
Okay.
I do think that they didn't want to deal with the Charest subplot. They didn't have enough good ideas about it. They were at most going to give her, you know, sort of one episode a season. They weren't going to make it because this show isn't about arcs, right? So it isn't about, you know, oh, here's five episodes to show all the things. So they couldn't make that, you know, even what, like Teal'c's son gets an episode a season, right? So all these things, they don't know how to deal with them. I think it's true they don't know how to deal with women either. But I don't think it's quite so bad as they want to make Jackson not married anymore because they just don't want to have anybody in a relationship that will take more than an episode to deal with per season. So I do, again, I have a different interpretation of how they deal with Linnea in the next episode that I think will give it at least a somewhat more positive spin. So, but we'll wait till we get to that.
Right, we'll get to that. Let's see. I didn't like how O'Neill treated Rothman. Maybe that's just how he deals with all scientists. I don't really believe what Jackson said about, you know, O'Neill acts that way because he's deeply insecure about scientists being smarter than him. I think O'Neill just likes being a smartass. I really don't get the feel of O'Neill having to take the scientists down a peg in order to feel more secure about himself. I think that may be Daniel's interpretation, but I don't buy it.
I don't buy that either. I agree with you that that is not quite the motivation behind O'Neill's reactions. I did want to also call it just, I felt, regarding Teal'c having no option but kill Sharae, also felt a little cheap.
Yeah.
I'm actually a little surprised that a single staff weapon blast could kill a Gould. There's that. But I'm also a little offended that Teal'c couldn't come up with something better to do. He could have shot off her hand. He could have knocked her out. He could have zatted her. He could have just knocked her down. It didn't feel like...
Yeah, he could have just charged into her and broken the ribbon weapon.
It didn't really feel like there was no other option. That was just the show didn't have time or didn't want to deal with it. And usually that's the case when a character has to make a hard decision. But it felt a little weak. They also never really answered the question of why they couldn't then go find a sarcophagus. I think the show does have answers to some of those questions. Like in one of the dreams, the Tok'ra healed her. I don't think the Tok'ra liked the sarcophagus very much. They recognized that those are bad. But I also don't know where Amonet's ship was. Where did all these Gould come from? Wouldn't they have had a sarcophagus with them? So there's aspects of that where it felt just a little hand-wavy, and it's just the show didn't have time or care to answer those questions. There were so many Jaffa killed in this episode. I was amazed by the battle scene. The first thing I thought was, boy, that battle must have been expensive. They had the cute little Melp with a cannon on it or a machine gun on it. It was very cute. Right. It didn't work very well.
Yeah,
it looked like a very expensive battle. And the one question that it really gave me was, the Gould are obviously very racist, and they're very much like about the Gould, but they really don't care about each other very much, because every time a Jaffa gets killed, that is a Gould being killed too. Like, there are snakes littering the battlefield at the end of this episode. And one, they don't collect them. But two, I just find it a little strange, actually, that the Gould have no actual interest in other Gould's lives either, to such an extent. It didn't really occur to me until I watched this episode how cheap they consider other Gould's lives. Certainly not when they're without a host. Because all of the ones in Jaffa are fodder.
Well, they are very hierarchical, and every other Gould is either a potential rival for your own position, or if you're high enough, a potential supplanter. So they didn't build their society by bonding with each other and working with each other. They built their society by stealing from other people. And, you know, I guess it kind of makes sense that they don't think much of the races that they enslave and exploit, because that's basically what they do with each other too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't, it's not a failing in the show. It's just interesting. Like, I think the show ought to really dig more into that. The way the Gould treat Gould is, I think, an understated, except between system lords, is maybe just too deep for this show. But it feels like something that was underexplored.
Yes. I think when you started to think these thoughts, that's when the show isn't interesting enough to keep you involved in the immediate action.
But the battle had nice booms.
That's what I think. I do think that it was probably less expensive than you might think, because there wasn't that much in the way of special effects. It was just a whole bunch of extras in armor charging over a hill. Like, again, just a big muddy field again.
So much pyrotechnics, though.
So, yeah. But it is, yeah. And there were more extras than there usually are, right?
Far more, yeah.
Definitely.
But they do say at some point in the middle, you know, they killed all of them, right? And we don't get to see that. And they seem to be in more danger than that, that they could just wipe out all these Jaffa. So.
Yeah, it is kind of odd that they would blow so much of their extras budget on a non-climactic battle that, you know, actually just drops you into the middle of the beginning of the episode instead of being something that you build toward. But I guess that helps change things up and keep things fresh, maybe? Maybe. All right, let's see. It was nice to see Kasuf again, Sharae's father.
Yep.
I did like how they did the funeral scene for Sharae.
Yes.
And Daniel started out translating everything and finally just was finishing in English, which I thought was rather disrespectful to Kasuf and the other Avedonians, but what can you do?
Did anyone ever try and answer the question of how accurate do we feel this funeral rite may have been for ancient Egyptians?
I certainly have heard of the balancing a feather against a scale to see if your soul is clean.
Yep.
Other than that, I don't know.
Yeah, but the gods do that. I don't know if they do that at the funeral.
Ah.
I'd be curious to know from whether the rites of like having them bound and in a reed boat-like thing and then dumped with sand that way. Like, I was curious if they actually did research to try and set up that scene. But it played out very well.
Perhaps the Abaddonians have evolved their own funeral rites and they're not supposed to be directly the same as the Egyptians.
That's the other thing, yeah.
Yep, that's also a very valid.
All right, anything else on this one? Or shall we move on to Season 3, Episode 11, Past and Present?
Let's do it.
David?
SG-1 shows up in an abandoned warehouse on Vias. They meet a couple people and find a puzzle planet. Everyone lost their memories a year ago. There are no children or older people. They only found records of old people. Lenia was here.
Dun, dun, dun.
Kira seems to be in charge, and Jackson starts flirting with her. The guest stars return to SGC for tests. Jackson and Kira sleep together, and then Carter drops, "Is Kira actually Lenia?" Carter and Frasier try to cure the amnesia, but they need Kira's help. Kira learns the truth, helps create a cure, and sneaks it. Somehow. Lenia finds her own identity conflicted and threatens to blow herself up with the foreshadowed chemicals, but Jackson proposes a memory wipe to fix her. Kira then heads off to a planet full of people passing around amnesia cures.
Yeah, surely nothing bad will come of that.
You know, up until that very ending, I really liked most of this episode, but that last scene where she goes to the planet where everyone's passing around the amnesia cure pissed me off.
All right. So given that we're just following from Forever in a Day, I do want to talk about Daniel and relationships a little bit. When Kira comes, I didn't get the sense of Daniel flirting with Kira, just working with her and respecting her, and I thought it was Kira who came on to him first. Anyway, he resists a little tiny bit and says, my wife just died. Well, actually, I lost her a long time ago.
It's complicated.
And so she persists, and, you know, as you say, they get together.
Man, that room gets a lot of action.
I don't like this. I don't like how easily, well, I don't know. Maybe Daniel needs consolation, maybe. But it just felt a little icky to me. Also, the whole thing about the people on this planet don't want to have relationships with each other because what if they wake up from amnesia and, you know, they're with the wrong people? That doesn't seem to really consider infidelity at all if Kira is saying, oh, but you're not from this planet, so I don't have any prior relationship with you. Totally ignoring the fact that she might have been married to somebody else before the amnesia. We know now that that's not the case because she turns out to have been at least the restored-to-youth body of Lenia. Although, you know, Daniel keeps insisting you're not Lenia until it's genetically proven to him. Anyway, I'm not fond of how quickly he has sex right after Sharae's death, and didn't like that. The rest of the episode, I liked a lot. I thought it was really interesting. I liked the little clues that they were scattering around, like they're all basically the same age. There are no old people or young people, but oddly, there are pictures of old people, but no kids at all. So I thought that was interesting as we build into the mystery of what happened on this planet and how they figure things out. I enjoyed the puzzle solving on this episode.
The puzzle box, I think, was pretty good, but let's dig further into this relationship choice. So what was your thoughts about it, Andrew?
Oh, yeah. So I think they deliberately put this right after Forever in a Day, so that Daniel would, there would be a reason to write into the episode that Daniel would not fall in love with her, right? Like if this had happened like four episodes later, they would have had to have come up with another reason why Daniel would not just hook up with Lenia, you know, for good and want to be with her and, you know, So this gives them an easy out of saying, oh no, I can't, you know, I can't be in a relationship with you because I'm still getting over my wife. I think it's that simple. I think it's that surface level and that simple that they just wanted a reason to keep him unattached and to keep him going back to that reset at the beginning of each episode where he's just back to being himself and doesn't have a lot of long-term attachments. And this was the way they decided to do it.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe Michael Shanks was tired of being a grass widower on the show and asked the writers, can't you find some way to get rid of Sheree so that I can have relationships with other people or my character can? Something like that.
As his Captain Kirk moment.
Maybe. I don't know. I guess one could dig into things on the internet and see if they could find out something like that, but I have not done the research.
Look, I think that's an interesting take in that you're saying they avoided the long-term relationship by making it nearby the other episode. I don't think I even that occurred to me because there is no such thing as a long-term relationship in this show outside of the potential leads, because that's just not how these shows worked. So it didn't occur to me. Like, these shows are always about relationships with guest stars.
The team.
That's who you hook up with.
Yeah.
Because that's convenient and easy, and you never have to see them again. But it being right after the other episode is what made me feel like they got rid of Sheree so they can do this. As like,
yeah.
Wow, that just stings.
Yeah, pretty blatantly, yes.
It feels blatant, and I think giving a couple episodes distance wouldn't have stung, I think, so badly. I'm still mourning Sheree, even if the show wishes us to move on, which is what I feel the show is telling us to do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mind the people are a little hesitant to hook up because they don't know who each other are.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that actually was a reasonably clever line. I agree about the infidelity angle being ignored, but I liked, there's some thought that went into that line that I did actually kind of like. That the idea of something happening creating new and unusual social taboos, that isn't actually used as a mechanism in plots very often. So I actually kind of liked that aspect of it. But jumping into this relationship, didn't feel right.
Yeah, it is interesting, though, to see that, you know, this is basically a way where people could get, I don't know about eternal youth, but certainly a second youth. I don't know how many times this process could be repeated. You grow old, you take the thing again, you're young, you take the antidote so you get your memories back. But presumably that could be, it would be worth testing at least once to see if you could do that. that would be another show, I suppose, but I think it raises interesting speculations. Certainly there would be some people on Earth who would be deeply interested, even if not SGC. Some people on Earth with deep pockets would do a lot to get hold of this mystery rejuvenation drug and the antidote.
Though, funnily, when they got the mind-wiping dose, it didn't actually have the de-aging anymore. It only had the wiping, and they kind of just ignored all the necessary work that may have been needed to cause that, because Kira doesn't get younger again, which is convenient.
True. So maybe it only works once.
Be funny, right, if she were a teenager at the end of that.
Oh, right.
They could have given us that wouldn't have been a bad way of ending it, because then they could just turn her into an 8-year-old. You got another excuse to bring in a kid actor, and then you have a better argument for her able to grow up and not become Linnea. Like, honestly, I think that might have been a better ending.
Yes, it certainly seems as though something could happen, and it could be Linnea could turn into her old, horrible, ruthless self again. One does wonder a little bit what happened to Linnea growing up to make her such a horrible person, that when she loses her memory, Kira turns out to be very kind and dedicated to helping others.
When also this idea that Linnea can feel the psychology of her older self reasserting itself. It's funny, when I was taking notes on this, I was thinking that this feels, of course, this doesn't really psychological at all, right? This doesn't really make a lot of sense. This feels almost sort of more fairy tale-like, right? Like this idea that she is inhabited by an evil spirit, that it will control her unless it is banished in some way. You know, in terms of like actual modern psychology, like, you know, dude, if you have bad thoughts, if you have feelings of wanting to control others and hurt others, like do the work, work on it and control yourself and, you know, get some therapy and everything, right? Like, the, you know, you don't have to kill yourself to become a better person. You have to just want to become a better person. And again, the show is not interested in that at all, right? The show wants to make it this unavoidable thing that needs to be stopped in some other fashion.
Well, I may be mistaken, but I seem to recall that some very bad mental habits do end up having biological effects on you that kind of lock you into those behaviors. And so I could imagine that having the memories restored might tend to snap you back into your bad habits.
I really quite liked the conflicted Kira slash Linnea scenes. I thought I cannot make an assumption of how realistic having two sets of memories are. That are in so obviously direct conflict with each other. I think that's interesting. And I actually quite like that aspect of it.
Yeah, having recently read the Hugo Award Best Novel of 2024, the Emily Tesh book. Anyway, there's a thing in that where two different personalities from different timelines end up sharing space. And Some Desperate Glory, that's the name of the book, sorry. Having conflicts about how they're going to behave now that, is it a melded personality? Does one person become dominant? How are they going to handle that? So yeah, a lot of actually pretty good science fiction stories do kind of address that identity question.
So I do think the, you know, a lot of the reason why this episode works as well as it does is because of the guest star, again, because of the guest star. So this is Megan Leach, who, for those of you who were watching television back in the 90s, she played Mulder's missing sister in some of the episodes of The X-Files. So if she seems familiar to you, that's why. She certainly seemed familiar to me from those times. And I think she did a pretty good job of, you know, again, showing this character and showing the conflict and everything else. And that was the point of this, right? Like, again, I keep going on about what starts an episode, I think, in the writer's mind. And that was this, right? This idea of this character who being conflicted and being good, being also being this evil person, and how to show that dramatically, how to make that a cool, dramatic moment. And they did. They focused on that a lot. I do think that they don't care that much about a lot of, in this episode, as in many others, ramifications often don't interest them. There is no mention of the fact that these people couldn't have children before, and can they have children now? Because if they can't, they're still screwed, right? They're still a dying population.
Very good point. Are they still sterile because of that insecticide?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Good point.
Let's assume not.
And then the other side of it, of course, is, you know, they wanted that dramatic moment where Kira is doubtful about what's going on, but goes anyway, goes back anyway. And there's virtually no system, there's virtually no world where this woman who is established to me super smart and super, you know, on top of things will not eventually figure out again who she is and what that is. And will that mean she'll go bad then? Like, again, this feels like this could have, this was like almost like the start of an adventure rather than the end of one, because leaving her back there with this doubt in her mind is absolutely going to lead to another bout of her becoming Linnea again. And it's just a matter of time, but they don't care about that because they wanted that dramatic moment of her being doubtful and leaving anyway. And I will, sad news, David, there is no part three to the Linnea arc.
I'm amazed.
In SG-1. So this is it.
I honestly thought they might show us again.
Oh, that's funny because I thought she had something to do with a thing that happens later that I can't talk about because of spoilers. Well, if Andrew says that's the only one, presumably you saw that in a database somewhere.
I don't think she gets another full episode. I will double check about anything else. But in any case, so, and one thing that we've, that I've been doing and doing with this group of people actually is that we have been, I think we mentioned before, the Stargate SG-1 role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
And in the time between when we mentioned that in a previous episode and now, it's been a while and we've actually had our own little mini campaign of this. And one of the fun things that I've been doing in those games is exploring, again, some of these ramifications that the shows tend to leave on the floor of what happens to a planet after SG-1 blunders in and makes all these changes, right? And I do think that it would make for another pretty cool RPG game session to say, hey, here's another shot at what happens to Linnea after this.
Yeah, I'm for it.
I'm kind of shocked that they didn't plan or do another Linnea episode, given that they send her back to the planet full of the cure that would fix her and bring back Linnea. Like, oh, that ending. Like, you could send her anywhere else. She'll do fine. But sending her back to that planet, I was just beyond me. And the only excuse for it would be is they're setting up the next Linnea episode. And if they don't even do that, I...
Nope, they're just lazy.
Wow, that is so, so lazy.
So remind me, does everyone else on her planet know that she was Linnea and she's the only one that doesn't? Or did the SGC keep it from the other?
At least some of them do, I think.
Yeah.
Well,
Yeah, she's gonna figure it out.
they wouldn't recognize her either, but everyone would know that she's the only person who no one remembers. Like, there's only so many missing people. It depends how many people died,
right?
But it'd be hard for it not to be sort of at least guessed at.
Mm-hmm. Right, and she's the only amnesiac. So yeah, something. Definitely.
I will once again remind us that we are thinking about this much more than the show is.
I thought I actually recognized Megan Leach from this episode from her voice. But if that was the case, it is from her playing Boom Boom in X-Men Evolution. that was my knowledge for her, the actor.
Yep. So, but I think, you know, this is a fun little episode, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely think that one is worth watching, even if it is, as Andrew says, only, you know, a minor two-episode arc from, what was it, Prisoners before and this episode, Past and Present.
This is easily the best of the three episodes. It's still I found frustrating. This was a very frustrating set of episodes. We'll see going forward. This was stressful, but there was very specific reasons why it was stressful. So we'll see episodes going forward. There was a bit of Stargate science that I wanted to throw out. There's the line, "You could stand here for months pressing symbols and still not find a combination." The U.S. government was playing with combinations for decades, and they couldn't figure one out, which is maybe reasonable because of the billions of possible combinations. But I think they should have made maybe years would have sounded better in that line. They never quite make it clear how hard it is to randomly guess a Stargate. Sometimes it's a massive impossible thing, and sometimes it's just unlikely. That was funny.
Mm-hmm.
I liked some aspects of the writing. I really, really liked Carter's scenes where she was ramping up to the "what if Kira is Linnea?" And I really liked how Carter sort of went step to step to step to step. And you don't know, like, how many steps does it take for the audience to know where it's going to go, and it's probably variable. But I thought it was very nicely done. I could imagine a show wanting to leave that to be what's discussed in the last 5 minutes and it being a big reveal, but this isn't modern TV. But one halfway through the episode, we're going to tell you what the real plot is and the secret, all the secrets. And I quite liked that reveal at that point. Yeah, and it matched nicely with happening simultaneously with Jackson making the questionable decision to sleep with her. So it was a nice story structure there. One writing bit I didn't like very much, she asked if the guards that showed up outside of her door were normal, and Jackson said they were normal, but they weren't there before, so obviously they're not normal.
Right.
I don't know if that was Jackson lying badly or just them being weird or the writers being weird. I don't know what was going on there.
I assumed it was Jackson lying badly.
Sure.
Yep.
The one thing that the show didn't sell at all was the first time I watched the episode, I assumed that Linnea got the cure by stealing the ampules. But on the second time viewing, no, I realized that the ampules, the two different ampules being stolen, was callback to the previous bit where you could only add 3% of the other thing or else it'll explode.
Mm-hmm.
That was the setup for that. I'd missed that in my first showing. But that meant that Linnea cured herself by getting the remains of a drop off of a slide into her carotid artery directly to cure herself with. Is like, I don't think she really had access. I wish they had better sold her stealing the or giving herself the cure. They didn't really have an idea how she did that. And I was like, you just glossed over that.
Oh, no, they did. There's the moment where what's-her-face, Dr. Fraser says, oh, the thing that we were going to inject into the second resident, it's gone.
No, but I thought that was the ampules for the bomb. And I think she had already taken the cure at that point.
Right. Yeah, I think so, too. But they do mention that she stole the cure.
Maybe? I don't know.
And so I don't know if we're shown that, because I think what we're shown is her stealing things that can make a bomb, but maybe not. Yeah, it's not that clear. But Dr. Fraser very clearly says, oh, the ampule for the cure is missing.
Definitely some ampules were missing. Like that was sort of the line. And but then
some ampules.
Linnea was always being watched up until that point, and then she either subconsciously or for some reason used the same phrase, because she obviously had remembered while going into the room.
Yeah.
So I think she had to have been cured before witnessing that. So, and I think that was getting the bomb. Like, something in there was just a little fragile there, because we see her just looking at the slide. Because we knew she stole a slide earlier, even though Teal'c was watching her at the time. Yeah. But yeah, there was an aspect of her getting the cure that was not handled very well.
Right. Yep. Fair enough.
All right. Well, I think that about does it for this time. Next episode, we'll be discussing a few more Stargate 1 Season 3 episodes. So I guess that's about it for this one. If anyone wants to get in contact with us, you can look at sgfun.space. What are some of the other ways people can get in contact with us?
Well, I do think that just going to the website will give you all of our sort of contact information. So I think probably enough for us to specify that at this point.
Okie doke.
We haven't had that single website in the past, so we've rattled off a number of different things. But I think we can go ahead and just say, you know, sgfun.space from now on. Go look at that and you'll find our Mastodon account. You'll find all the things you need to reach us and watch our episodes.
Fair enough. Sounds good. Okay. Well, certainly do listeners please get in contact with us if you want to ask us any questions about our thoughts about the show. And I guess that'll do it for that time, unless any of you have any final thoughts
for some better episodes.
I believe there are some better episodes coming along, David. Andrew.
All right. Yep, we'll see you next time.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening.